If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
And we are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley on Beyond the Bricks here. Inside of a week now of the 110th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson, the other voice you hear on this program, who accumulates all of the audio that you hear historically that tell the stories of the personalities, the drivers, all of the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Landon Coons puts it all together for us. And Mike, it is a special pleasure tonight because tonight we decided rather than playing audio, which we will do, that instead of the two of us bantering back and forth, why not bring in one of the most legendary voices to join us on this installment of Beyond the Bricks? And Mike, this is a true joy tonight to bring in our guest.
Yeah, we have definitely a special guest tonight, and it's way better than listening to me talk when you can bring in a true legend of the Speedway, the chief announcer for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network from 1977 to 1987, and also the former television voice of the 500, Mr. Paul Page joins us tonight. Mr. Page, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you guys? Good to hear your voice. Good to hear from you too, Jake.
Paul, it's a pleasure. And it was a pleasure to work racing broadcast with you because of the legendary status you hold. And I want to get right to that right away. And that is when Sid Collins first brought you in 1974 as part of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. And I want to begin right to it here, Paul, with letting you again hear Sid Collins introducing you on the radio network.
As we roar with the cars out of turn four, we move into the pits. It's much longer this year, 856 feet longer to be exact, and 5 feet wider than a year ago. We have five men roaming this distance compared with three in past years. And starting with our second rookie, we begin to move down the crucial pit area. In his high school yearbook, this young man's ambition, as he listened to the 500 broadcast on the radio, was to someday be a part of this team. Today, 11 years later, he's realizing that desire. In the North Pits, also with three rookie stripes on his microphone, is Paul Page.
Thank you, Sid, and it is indeed a pleasure, and I'm quite proud to be here today. I'm standing on new concrete. This is the new extension to the pit area. From here, I have a clear view to the number four turn, where the wall has been moved back, as Jim Shelton mentioned, and this pit entrance has been widened. This should be an action area when the green flag comes out later today. Back to you, Sid.
Thank you, Paul, and welcome to you as well as a new member of the broadcast team from Indianapolis.
That didn't choke me up at all.
How often have you heard that?
Probably 77, 78. Probably the last time I heard it was when I was doing my review of the 77 race. So that's very, very special. That's 50 years ago, baby.
How was the relationship with you and Sid? You know, you talked about how it came to be that you got the call. And in the early years of you, and obviously there were not a lot of years that you were, and we'll get to that, that you worked with Sid, but what was the dynamic in terms of the responsibilities of working with and answering to Sid and meeting the expectation that was placed upon you?
Well, of course, first of all, he was my best friend. And he definitely was my mentor, but he was a perfectionist. He was a very demanding guy. And if you did something wrong, Sid would very definitely let you know it. Not in a mean way, but, you know, he was the boss. He knew how to do it, and you didn't. So He'll explain it to you. I remember one year I was sent out by WIBC to cover the Kentucky Derby. Or excuse me, the Soapbox Derby. And I did a nice interview, I thought, with the winner and everything. And I headed back to the station, and the interview was already on the air. And I walked in the lobby at WIBC, and Sid is standing there with his arms crossed. And he looks at me just shaking his head. And I'm like, whoa. He said, that's the worst interview I've ever heard. But typical of Sid, that was the door opening so that he could tell you how an interview ought to be done. And that probably was a 4 or 5 week exercise just to learn that. And he was so creative, but he understood the radio media as well. So just being his friend, him being my mentor, was the best relationship I've ever had.
You know, throughout that time, Paul, that you were working with Sid, at any point did you begin to envision or even think about the aspiration of maybe someday becoming the chief announcer? Although he was so already obviously entrenched as that, and I'm assuming that early on it was your expectation that it was going to be that way for an extended period of decades as opposed to the brief time, correct?
Oh, absolutely. He had told me once, I'm going to put you in to be the guy who replaces me. But like you just said, I'm thinking, okay, that's 20 years from now, because it's 50, you know, it's 50s. And to have him depart this life so early and for such stupid reasons, it broke all of our hearts. But we put more into that broadcast, I think, because of it.
Paul, we know Paul Page is our guest here on Beyond the Bricks. We're talking right now about the early years of your relationship with Sid Collins. And, you know, we know so much about Sid Collins for those of us that were not obviously beside him at that time. We know him in voice and in clips and in narration and illustration. But you knew him beyond that. You knew him when the microphone was not on. I don't know that we've heard a lot about Sid Collins, the person, the character, aside from the broadcast perfectionist. What kind of guy was he?
Sid was, in many ways, as a friend, difficult to know. He was very guarded, and you can understand why with the positions he held. He was very guarded about who his friends were. He wanted to make sure that you weren't just there to try to take advantage of him. And sometimes I think he overdid it, but now I've filled that position, I quite understand it. I mean, I almost as soon as I took over, I had people coming to me and saying, Sid said that I would be on the radio network. And absolutely not true, because Sid kept me totally in the loop. But you had to guard against those kind of things, and he had to, because if somebody got a chance to use him, they would try and do that. Sid was smarter than all of them.
And Paul, through the mentoring and through the friendship and all of it, you know, unfortunately, the reality is obviously that Sid Collins was lost on May 2nd of 1977. And that was just a few weeks before what would be a historic race and a historic month. You had Janet Guthrie, obviously, in that race. It would become A.J. Foyt's fourth win. We didn't know it at the time, but it was also the final race for Tony Holman. So you have all of these storylines, some of which you knew, some of which you didn't yet know were going to happen, but it was still a marquee signature event, perhaps at the apex of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, and you have the emotion, the dichotomy of it, of knowing that you have lost your friend, your mentor, your boss, but you also then are handed the torch of a responsibility to broadcast the Indianapolis 500-mile race. You and Jim Shelton put together that tribute, and this is how it sounded on the broadcast of the 1977 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Sid Collins, the voice of the 500 for almost 30 years, is not here with us today. But I'm sure in spirit he is cheering for all this broadcast crew. He was that type of man. Today in spirit, he has the safety of all these fine drivers in mind. He was that type of man. Through the many years here at the 500, Sid was an advisor, brother, father, and counselor for drivers, mechanics, and all of us on the broadcast crew. His advice and counsel will remain with all of us through the years. His ability as a fine broadcaster will remain with you listeners for a long time. He was a perfectionist. He accepted a job to do. The job was well done. May 2nd, Sid Collins passed away. He had contracted ALS, the Lou Gehrig disease. We'll miss Sid Collins. He was our friend, but he was a friend of yours too. Sid was a man of great ability, articulate, and a gentleman through and through. But Sid Collins knew that no man is indispensable, and will be cheering all of us on to do a good job like he always wanted us to do. Now, please join all of us in a moment of silence in memory of Sid. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And now, here is Sid's good friend, race driver, broadcaster, and a well-qualified man, in our new voice of the 500, Paul Page.
Thank you very much, Jim Shelton, and greetings from Indianapolis. This broadcast crew deeply feels the loss of our leader, Sid Collins, and we are here today going to perform in the way that he would have wanted us to, the way that he taught all of us for many, many years. We hope that you will join with us in dedicating this 61st running of the 500-mile race to Sid Collins.
Paul, was it easier in 1977 that you had so many historic things to talk about? Did that make it any easier? I mean, obviously losing Sid was so devastating, but you had so many exciting storylines to talk about with Janet Guthrie's historic run and Tom Sneva's, pole break, the 200-mile-an-hour mark being broken. Did that make it any easier? Obviously, A.J. Foyt's fourth victory. Did that help at all, take your mind at all off of what you guys had lost in Sid?
I don't think so. That race especially was, I just have to get this done. I just have to get it done. I have to get it done right. And I have to serve that audience. And I have to be proud of that broadcast team, which I always have been. It was more business, I think, in that you knew you had to go through the month. I only had from May 2nd to race day to put everything together. It's not like there was anything yet prepared for that. And so, we were focused on doing a good job, and the guys were trying to help me all along. They were all right there. One of my favorite moments, though, was about 15 seconds before we went on the air. Jack Morrow, who was our producer and prominent local broadcaster, leaned over and put his hand out to shake my hand, and I put mine out. We shook hands, and he looked at me, and he said, "Paul, there are 13 million listeners out there. Don't screw this up." So it was just the comic relief that I needed.
And, that race itself, Paul, all of the storylines, all of the drama going into it, and, of course, we didn't know that that would also be the final race for Tony Holman as well at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But
right. You
got to call it, and we're going to listen to it now. The first of the four-time winners, and we'll talk about how special that was for you, but let's first listen to the way that Paul Page, you called it, when A.J. Foyt became a four-time winner at the Indianapolis 500.
The white flag is waved for A.J. Foyt. Here is Ron Carroll.
All right, Paul, thank you. We have him in the view, and hey, this is going to be the first guy to win over $1 million at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. With this fourth win, he's over in turn two. Howdy Bell pick him up.
Riding smoothly around the line, drifts back out to the wall, up the backstretch to Darrell Weibel.
From the dusty tracks of Texas to Racing's Hall of Fame, and there goes Foyt toward turn three. Doug Zink.
And the crowd on its feet is A.J. Foyt. They're waving at him, waving him on through turn number three, off of three, into the short chute. Here's Jim Shelton.
Hey, the crowd is up there cheering, as you can hear in the background. Not only the eyes of Texas, but the eyes of the world are on this great man. And now to call the checkered flag, our chief announcer, who did call a great race today, Paul Page.
A.J. Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. A.J.'s hand in the air. He is the winner. A.J. Foyt at Indianapolis has won his fourth 500-mile race. A.J. Foyt, our winner.
Paul, it has always struck me as almost fitting that A.J. Foyt would win that race, because I know you had a friendship, a tremendous respect for A.J. Foyt, and a mutual respect at that. But in a year that would be your first and would be such an emotional one, it seemed to me very fitting that A.J. Foyt would be the winner.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned the other things, Janet Guthrie, Sneave, et cetera. That all just kind of came together to make that such a special time. And it seemed to complement the fact that Sid had done all those races and didn't get to do this when it's the one he should have done.
Yeah, I mean, to be able to call all four of them, of course, he would have been on the mic for, you know, the first three of those, it goes without saying. Were you aware of, Paul, or thinking about Sid Collins or the way he would have called it as the responsibility was falling on you to do exactly that?
No, I was taking some of Sid's advice. Do it the way you want to do it. Learn from what the rest of us have done and digest that, and then do it the way you think is appropriate. You can't be me. And you can't be any of those other people. You have to be Paul.
Of course, 5 years later, Paul, you and your team would get to call what I believe either 1982 or 1992, I think, are the greatest closing laps in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, which would mean 1982 is the greatest because it was the first. It was this incredible finish that was happening before your eyes and unlike anything we'd ever seen before. So I want to get your comments on it. But first, for the audience, here's how it sounded as Rick Mears, seemingly lap by lap, was shaving off a second a lap, trying to reel in Gordon Johncock, the completion of the 1982 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
And Mears is right there.
Like the start of this race. Johncock, then Mears, they're in turn two.
Now Gordy pulls away a little bit as Mears gets a little squirrely in turn number two. They're on the back stretch. It's still Gordon Johncock. Mears is trying, but he's about 10 car lengths behind as they streak down this 5/8 of a mile back stretch to turn three.
Less than half a lap ago, Gordy Johncock by 5 car lengths over Rick Mears. They're in the north short shoot.
Here they come. This is the final quarter lap. Johncock maintains the lead. The voice of the 500, Paul Page.
Paul, one of the things to me, before we get to your call on that, that has always jumped out at me, and I've always said this each time I've listened to that call, I thought it was a brilliant call by the man that would ultimately, when you would go to television, take over in the booth, not directly, but eventually in Bob Jenkins. I thought Jenkins did a fabulous call there because he perfectly set the scene. He perfectly threw to you and introduced you. But he never cracked his voice. The composure to be able to show the enthusiasm and excitement of it while still keeping it within broadcast meter, to me, shows the greatness of the apex of the team that you put together.
Well, and as you know, Bob, God rest his soul, was one of my best friends. I brought him on the radio network. And he learned the same lesson that I did, which was, You never go all the way to the top. If you're sitting along, like unfortunately so many announcers are, and they're just 100% all the time, when something really happens, you have no place to go to. So Bob is totally following that concept. He's got his voice at a controllable level, yet it's conveying excitement. And, you know, this may give a lot of people, you know, the rest of us broadcasters, but radio doesn't just happen. Television doesn't just happen. There is all kinds of considerations and preparations and just key understandings to what it is that you're doing. And Bob showed one of them right there. He was perfect.
One of the things, Paul, that I had to train myself, so to speak. And I'm curious if you ever had this. It sounds like you did, same kind of consideration. It took me a while before I eventually just figured out naturally that a pass on lap 70 has to be called differently than a pass on lap 170, even if it's as breathtaking, because of the moment itself. Did you have to condition yourself also to learn the same?
I did. And that's a really good point, because that's that level, you know, maybe I'm running along at 70% on the standard call, but then something like that happens, you may bounce up to 85, and then you come back down. Got to keep that whole voice thing is what the audience has to trigger off of in radio. And so it was very important to make sure you were in the right place. And when you got to the last 20 laps, then you had plenty of room to go when something happened. I would, though, add the 100th race in with that good finishes, though.
Yeah, that one was obviously, that one, the 100th was surreal because of the Rossi, you know, is he going to make it or not? And it was different because at that time we're looking at speeds that were the equivalent of 1972. And this one in 1982, you had that close a finish, Paul. What is your recollection of how you were able to explain how close it was and at the same time be able to rattle off the clock of how close it was?
Well, there was something that really helped us. That was the first year of the digital stopwatch. And so you could do laps on it. I mean, it had everything that you couldn't do when you had just two analog watches. And so we were all playing with them. I mean, they were a great toy. Well, I realized by watching it, I was timing interval, that about lap 70, that if everything went right, that Gordon Johncock would have Rick Mears right behind him at the white flag, if not alongside. And so I told the broadcast crew, this is what we're following. Nothing but that interview, too. Something major happens, of course, we'll go to it. But we need to build this drama and this momentum up to the checkered flag. And, of course, the guys were incredible. They did every minute of it.
It was perfection, no question about it. And there were other things that became perfection within the career of Paul Page, many of which we will listen to and again reflect upon. When we come back with Paul Page, Mike Thompson, I'm Jake Query, and this is Beyond the Bricks.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Paul Page here. It's May in Indianapolis, and for the greatest spectacle in food, race fans are racing to Marsh Supermarkets. For a report from the deli section, let's go now to Ron Carroll.
Thank you, Paul, and let me tell you, the sight here in the deli section at Marsh is just fantastic. The fried chicken, the ribs, the cold cuts. Hey, there goes a party tray. And here comes a race fan if you got box lunches for this weekend. Back to you, Paul.
Well, there you have it. For the greatest spectacle in food, visit your nearby Marsh Supermarket.
Jake Query along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons putting it all together, and Paul Page, our guest tonight. Mike, I know obviously you just got done racing back from Marsh and the deli where Ron Carroll got you some of that fried chicken, right?
I got some chicken, I got some cold cuts and some cheese. I'm ready to go.
That's exactly right. And that is, of course, the key to any great race day. So too, a key to any great race day is getting set and pumped up for it. And nothing did anything like that better than the Delta Force theme. Paul, I know that you take great pride in this, and you can go on YouTube and watch all of the different Delta Force themes that took place over the year, and the way that it came together, still to this day, they get me pumped up. What was it about those ABC introductions once you moved to television? What was it that inspired you? How did you exactly put together each and every year those incredibly unique and at the same time scintillating opens to the Delta Force music?
Well, it was a distinct honor and privilege to be able to work with the late Don Allmeyer, who kind of set the stage for what everybody in television is doing in terms of style and production yet today. But what he did the first year, he came in on Tuesday and used the trucks were operational at the Speedway then. So he came in and we had the entire Indy 500 library in one semi. And that day, we're talking 1-inch or 2-inch tape. So it was a bunch of things there. So he started editing whatever he thought. His theory was, we are a visual medium. You have to put up the best possible shots all the time. So he edited a bunch of video together. And then on Wednesday evening, he would have that edit done, and he would come to me, and he'd hand me the tape, and he'd say, here, write to it. So I'm writing to his video, not way it's normally done, where you lay down the audio first and then match the video to it. We're actually letting the video itself guide the piece. And it usually took me till Friday late afternoon to get it all done and then get it laid down. And then we played it for the staff the next morning on Saturday morning for our rehearsal. I love those pieces. I've got a cult now. I mean, it's not just me doing them anymore. There are fans all over the place who have taken the whole Delta Force music and created their own opening to the 500. And I just think that's so cool. But I love the music. I love what we were able to do with it each year. But that is the way they did it. And I'm surprised that television has not seen how popular that is and brought it back in, not because of me, just the concept of the Delta Force opening, you know, with a lot of very fast cuts and very good video. Instead, I mean, television has gone to creating little dramas and a James Bond arrival and stuff like that. I think that they'd do very well if they'd stay with the Delta Force.
The 1991 Delta Force Open was my personal favorite because I liked that year notably. Fans' favorites, for the most part, it seems, is the 1992 Open. This is the Open to the Indianapolis 500 with the Delta Force music from 34 years ago.
For a sporting event. Indianapolis is dangerous. Its narrow road and concrete walls tear at man and machine. A skillful drive can turn to disaster without warning. But the quickest times are found just inches from the walls. It is there the bold must drive. Searching for the fastest lap, even the bravest are not without fear.
There's not been a race I have not been in that at one time or another I hadn't scared myself. And I'm one of the few that admit it. I know you got a bunch of brave heroes out there say they're not scared of nothing. All I can say, they've never run fast enough or they've never been hurt.
To drive Indy requires skill, to race at the front, dedication, to win, courage. A champion must push beyond fear. The four corners at Indianapolis draw out a special significance.
You know, there comes a time in a race where money doesn't matter, living doesn't matter. Winning is the only thing that matters. And so when you go into those corners, it's winning that tells all.
This past month at Indianapolis has challenged the elite, even the best. Like four-time champion Rick Mears came face-to-face with his own frailty. Rick would walk away. Three-time world champion Nelson Piquet barely escaped. But running on and over the edge is the only way to succeed, the only path to victory in the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
This place, more than any other, will probably push it to the limit, the very limit, because there's so much at stake. And there comes a time when you just say, man, you've got to go for it.
The time is now. 33 of the fastest have accepted the challenge and are ready for racing's ultimate test. 500 miles on a Sunday afternoon in Indiana. Where will the road take them? Too close to the walls or to Victory Lane with its fame and fortune? Indy is a human struggle against all odds. It brings pain and anguish, while at the same time, it conquers. memorable reward. In its 81-year history, 589 drivers have started the run. But the Indianapolis 500 has only permitted 54 to make the final turn into victory lane. As this day begins, the focus is 200 laps away. An antique cup waits for the new champion, whose likeness will be molded in silver to join the historic line. The 500 miles lie ahead.
That's how the Delta Force intro sounded in 1992. Paul, the beauty of that is not just that we knew that the race was about to happen, but also you were about to organize and orchestrate one of the beautiful tapestries with Sam Posey and Bobby Unser, the cast of characters that you had to lasso in over the course of 200 laps.
One of the best broadcast booths I ever had. Those two guys, they were always at each other on the air. They weren't privately. In fact, on a trip to Australia, 14 hours, they were sitting together on the airplane. They talked the whole 14 hours. But yeah, those were wonderful days. I love those days.
And so too did fans. By the way, A.J. Foyt, Alonso Jr., Mario Andretti, among those drivers you heard from within that open. And it would be in that race in 1992 when one of the great finishes between Alonso Jr. and Scott Goodyear would happen, and this is how it sounded on ABC television.
And Alonso Jr. sees Dwayne Sweeney's white flag. 2.5 miles. One more lap to go. If Scott Goodyear has a chance, the time is now. Don't forget, 10 years ago, John Cox and Rick Mears raced on the last lap for the finish. John Cox won that one. That was experience over Rick Mears' relative inexperience. Will that happen again here today? They're on the backstretch. 223 miles an hour on the last lap.
No traffic involved.
That's how it sounded in 1992. Paul, 4 years after that, you know, you had worked obviously in television doing kart races for a number of different networks, including in 1996, one of the legendary moments that happened. We simply call it the pass that happened in Laguna Seca. And it is a driver that we just lost actually within the last couple of weeks in Alex Zanardi, that was just a giant within racing. I want to play for you this clip and then get your thoughts on the great Alex Zanardi. Here is Paul with Danny Sullivan in 1996.
So the battle for the PPG Cup. Look, oh, look, here he comes, here he comes, here he comes, and he gets him! Can he get him back? Can he hang on?
Oh, and look at this!
Down through the first on the final lap. Alex Zanardi, remember, twice we've had the change on the final lap of the race this year. Alex Zanardi at the top of the hill, an area you would not normally try and pass. Ducks the inside of Brian Herta, goes all the way off the course on the right-hand side, and Alex Zanardi, with a brilliant move, takes the checkered flag from the pole and the win here at Laguna Seca. Unbelievable.
Paul, I think Alex Zanardi, you knew him well. Brilliant is the proper word to describe so many aspects of Alex Zanardi.
Brilliant, humorous, kind, just intelligent beyond belief. You had no idea how much he looked at each move in the race itself to understand it, but he never was particularly serious about it. So you didn't realize it unless you were very close to him, how intense he was on winning races. And it's sad that we've lost him. But that race, you know, in today's world, he would not have won it, because in today's world, we have on road courses, track limits, Formula One enforces it more than we do. But going off course and then coming back on and making a pass in the middle of it wouldn't have stood except under the rules then. It did.
It is impossible to go to the corkscrew at Laguna Seca and not within 30 seconds someone say to you, did you see Zanardi's pass? It is still a legendary moment in racing. Another legendary moment is the ending of the 2011 race. And, Paul, you were up in the radio booth. What I recall from that race was just kind of the mayhem and the confusion late in the race as J.R. Hildebrand. We were all incredulous at the fact that this rookie might win it, but it became kind of a fuel strategy race. You were the one up in the booth that immediately and was the first to recognize that Dan Weldon was the winner.
My son, Brian, is a chief performance engineer for Andretti, and he was on that car, the Weldon car, in that year. So, yeah, that, you know, and he hasn't given me a dime for that very expensive aerospace education. That was so much fun. Just for one reason, before the start of the race, Mike King, who was the voice then, and I talked about a couple of things about the call. And one of them was, you have to know the top five cars in your head. You can't be looking at a scoreboard or anything. You have to know who they are. And you cannot get fixated on anything but the win on the last laps. And unfortunately, that's what happened. Of course, the Weldon finish was not going to be nearly as good as Hildebrand's finish. I mean, that would have just been incredible. But so he's watching that. He's watching the crash. He's calling the crash. And I'm watching Weldon. And just because I knew that that could happen. And there it was. I mean, that was – but I felt so badly for Hildebrand.
This is exactly how it sounded in 2011.
Here he comes, the National Guard machine with J.R. Hildebrand down along the white line. He is sputtering slow, and he hits the wall. He hits the wall coming out of four. Will he have enough to cross the yard of bricks?
Here comes J.R. Hildebrand. He will cross in front of the flag stand with the checkered flag waving, the right side of the car destroyed. He finishes the race with the damaged race car. Who will win? Who is the winner?
Weldon.
Of the
Dan Weldon.
Dan Weldon has won the race as Weldon gets past J.R. Hildebrand as Hildebrand hits the wall.
A fabulous finish and a fabulous call right there by Paul Page, seeing that Dan Weldon would go on to win, and in that moment win the race. He led literally the last 200 yards of that race. Paul, it's been a pleasure and an honor, obviously, taking a look back at not only what the 500 means to you, but your brilliant career and your true contribution. There are very, very few people that you can list that have had a greater impact on the Indianapolis 500 without themselves running in the race than that of the impact of Paul Page. And to be able to look back on it all tonight, truly a pleasure and an honor.
Jake and Mike, I really thank you for the opportunity. You popped up some pretty good memories there.
Well, they're memories that were good for a lot of people, not just yourself, Paul, but thanks for sharing those moments and bringing them for memories for all of us. Appreciate it, Paul. We will see you trackside, all right?
You got it, guys. It's race day in Indianapolis coming.
That's right. That is Paul Page, the voice emeritus and still the voice of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and Indianapolis 500. We'll come back. We'll put a tie on all of it. Mike will let you know about something pretty cool coming on with the in relation to the Indianapolis 500. We'll do it on the other side.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. Thanks again to Paul Page for his awesome time this evening. Mike, in terms of being inside anywhere, Thursday from 3 until 8, Friday from 3 until 7, Saturday from 8 until 4, you will be inside the Memorabilia Show coming up in Plainfield.
That's right, at the Embassy Suites Event Center out in Plainfield, where I actually used to live. I used to live in Plainfield, so very excited about coming back to Plainfield for the Memorabilia Show. Looking forward to it. It's one of my favorite things each year, and there's something for everybody at the show, from a dollar all the way up to driver suits that cost, you know, $5,000. So really exciting time out there every year.
And how do folks get tickets?
You can come right to the door, and they have tickets right at the door. There's driver autograph sessions and giveaways and all those kind of things right there at the Embassy Suites, right at the front door in the Embassy Suites Event Center.
Okay, so again, starts Thursday. That's tomorrow night, obviously. From 3 until 8 o'clock, the Embassy Suites at Plainfield, the Memorabilia Show, and tickets are available. There are still some remaining. I looked at Eventbrite.com. So Eventbrite.com for the largest memorabilia show that can possibly in any way, shape, or form be thought of when it comes to racing. And, you know, I thought about this also, Mike, and I don't know – I'll never sell it, so it's kind of irrelevant, but I've told the story before, but whenever I can do this in show and tell, I always do. And so this seems to be good form for that. And it does not make me unique. I'm not alone in this. I speak for probably hundreds of race fans that have done very similar, certainly with flags. I know this has been a common theme. But a number of years ago, it's been, I can tell you, it would have been in 2012, because we had just lost Dan Weldon the previous year or within a year of the story that I'm telling. But I was at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I was inside the Impact Racing Garage where they sell authentic racing helmets. And I had this idea of getting a helmet and having it signed by all of the Indianapolis 500 winners. When I told the story to my mom, she asked if I meant all living winners. And I said, well, yes, Ray Haroon would be difficult. But I was contemplating whether to do this or not. And admittedly, Mike, as you know, when you work in with a credential, autographs are taboo. You know, there are certain, there's a decorum that goes with having access, credentialed access as a media member to races. But I'm still around enough with exposure to drivers to feel like it would be, there would be enough times where it would be prudent for me to get a helmet signed by every living winner of the Indy 500. As I was contemplating this, and it's not an inexpensive purchase, Mario Andretti walked in, and I thought that was a sign. So I went ahead and purchased one. I purchased the helmet. I had Mario sign it. The challenge then became, because of the frequency of resale when the two of them are on a helmet together, AJ Foyt will not sign things typically that Mario has already signed. So I felt like my project was already doomed when I asked AJ, and he would not sign it because he saw Mario's signature there. So I had you've got to be resourceful, right? I had a wing and wheel sticker signed by AJ Foyt, that one over the visor. I then began the quest. And I know that I'm not alone in this, but a lot of people, we talk about it because there are people that are doing the same and want to know how you get certain drivers, autographs, and those sorts of things. And certainly Beyond Autographs will be available at the Memorabilia Show. There will be everything from signage to advertisements to ticket stubs to magazines, all of it, photos, everything. But the helmet itself, I am pleased now to say that I got every winner of the Indy 500 from the, I've got to think here, from Parnelli to now, excluding those who were lost, were fatally injured before, or passed away before 2012. So it has, I believe, 36 drivers on it. Each year I have the pleasure, obviously, and the privilege, better way of saying it, with each driver to say, hey, if you win the race, then I'm going to, at a time that is appropriate to do so, have to get you this helmet. I will never sell it. I will ultimately probably have it donated to the museum because it does have all of the winners on it. And now at this point, I can say the easiest way to say it, it has every living winner signed along with Al and Bobby Unser, Gilles DeFerrin, and Parnelli Jones. They are the four that have passed since the time that they signed it. The driver that overlooked it and seemed to genuinely be the most impressed and fascinated by it upon signing it was actually Jacques Villeneuve. He looked over every single name. He asked about all of them. The only that was signed without my presence at the time of its signing was Danny Sullivan, who I FedExed to his house. And when he sent it back, he attached a note to it that thanked me for asking him to sign it and then told me that it was, quote, a privilege to put his name amongst all of the others that are on the helmet itself. I always thought that was very cool of Danny Sullivan. Very cool of Landon Coons to once again put together for us tonight Beyond the Bricks. Also, Mike, as always, a pleasure in doing it. We get closer and closer and closer now, and I promise we're going to try to keep it dry. But thank you for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
That's the sound of unaged whiskey transforming into Jack Daniel's Tennessee whiskey in Lynchburg, Tennessee. Around 1860, Nearest Green taught Jack Daniel how to filter whiskey through charcoal for a smoother taste, one drop at a time. This is one of many sounds in Tennessee with a story to tell. To hear them in person, plan your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.